We do not have a quorum. I'm sitting in for Chair Anderson right now. He has the bill hearing up, I believe, in another committee. So when he comes back, of course, we'll just move to a different location. What we're going to do until we get a quorum, we're just going to go ahead and ask the department to come up and give us their report on status of food hubs. So if Ms. Place could please come on. And Ms. Place, welcome to the committee. Once again, if you'd state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Whitney Place. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Agriculture. And today we have Paul Hugedin, the Supervisor of the Marketing Division at the department, to present our report on the status of food hubs in Minnesota.
Wonderful. So welcome once again. Can you state your name for the record?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Paul Hugedin. I'm supervising the marketing section, so not the whole division, just a part of it. So,
welcome.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to share just a real brief summary of our report on the status of food hubs in Minnesota. All of you should have a copy of it in your packets. I see some of you glancing at it. This report is the result of 2015 legislation that directed the MDA to consult with existing food hubs as well as University of Minnesota Extension. Our task was to identify best practices as well as recommendations to eliminate barriers to success. The bill also appropriated funds for grants to food hubs as well as other alternative community-based food distribution systems. The bulk of the research and analysis in the report was contracted to Cooperative Development Services, a regional nonprofit organization with offices here in St. Paul. In addition to their many years of experience in the local food system, the report is built upon in-depth interviews with Extension, 10 Minnesota food hubs, and an extensive review of national food hub research. I'd like to start with, while there are a lot of different ways to define a food hub, the general idea is that a food hub performs the basic functions of a regular food distributor, namely aggregation, distribution, and marketing. But the difference is that food hubs focus on sourcing food from local and regional producers who in many cases aren't large enough to do business with traditional distributors. A couple of key points for your consideration. There are currently about 15 food hubs operating in Minnesota. And nationally, there are at least 300 in various stages of development. Almost all of them are in the early startup phase. There is no single business model for food hubs. They differ substantially in their mix of products, services, supply channels, size, and seasonality. One key point is that while most traditional commercial distributors are focused primarily on gaining a profit, food hubs have a whole host of additional goals, and those things include supporting small family farms, fostering local economic development, increasing access to local food within the community, creating healthy food access for those of limited means, and building community around food and farm connections. Now, to this point, none of the smaller food hubs have yet achieved break-even status. And several of them report to us that their initial feasibility studies underestimated the operational costs, particularly labor costs associated with running a food hub. They also report significant price constraints, particularly with some of the institutional markets that they're trying to serve. The end result of that and the bottom line is that their target break-even sales levels are almost certainly understated. I think it's worth noting as well that much of the early national food hub research is not particularly helpful. Some of it's overly narrative, often telling encouraging stories written before the individual concept was proven and before the food hub has reached break-even. Some of the other national research includes a greater level of financial depth, but the results often take data from food hubs of widely varying size and averages them, which makes the data really difficult to use in a practical manner. Some of the background, this report calls out a handful of the significant reasons that food hubs have found it challenging to reach break-even. First and foremost is that Food distribution is a highly competitive business. Price competition is fierce. Customers expect consistently low prices with high levels of customer service. The existing food distribution system, not in Minnesota only, but nationwide, continues to consolidate at all levels. And the result is a series of very well-equipped, well-capitalized, established firms. Food distribution is an extremely high-volume, low-margin business. And for many of these food hubs, with the stated purpose of working with small farmers, what it means is that meeting that mission requires a trade-off with economic efficiency. Working with a higher number of small farms, providing small lots, requires more time and labor. Providing training to farmers has a cost. And many small producers lack cleaning, sorting, grading, cooling, and storing capabilities that are required when you start supplying the larger markets. And finally, operating a food hub that's built often around sourcing local foods creates a challenge because you're competing with distributors that are sourcing a full line of products year-round. So I realize so far all my comments are pretty negative in nature, and it sounds like a pretty bleak picture. So I'd also like to highlight some of the things that the report includes as far as recommendations to address some of these challenges. I think the biggest take-home that we would like to communicate to folks is that hub sponsors, champions, and managers need to be very clear about the financial requirements of operating a food hub, both during startup as well as on an ongoing basis. Food hubs need to think strategically, and they need to choose market channels strategically as well as product lines that have higher margin opportunities. Food hubs need to seek opportunities to use their staff, their equipment, and their facilities on a year-round basis to become more competitive. Food hubs need to think carefully about the geographic region that they're serving so that they can maximize sales opportunities as well as to be efficient in terms of their delivery and aggregation functions. And the last recommendation is that food hubs should consider partnerships with existing distributors. For example, it might make sense to focus on the sourcing and aggregating function of a food hub instead of trying to compete across the board with full-line distributors and trying to have full service. We're using the findings and recommendations in the report to finalize the RFP for grants that were authorized by this legislation. And what we anticipate is that we'll get several requests from existing food hubs that want to update their financial projections, possibly their business models, in an attempt to reach break even and become financially sustainable in the long term. I'd also like to point out that the initial report in your packets makes reference to a more detailed follow-up report that was included in our contract with CDS. That report is now available. I'd be happy to provide it to any of you. We'll also be putting it on our website at MDA. My name and contact information is on the cover of the report that's in your packet. What's in the larger report is one thing of particular value. It includes generic food hub break-even benchmarks. And that's really critical because, as I mentioned, a lot of these food hubs are starting to realize that their initial projections were overly optimistic. That break-even level appears to be significantly higher than what many of them expected it to be when they started. The report also includes a much more detailed review of the national literature and a more in-depth look at the barriers and strategies to overcome them. With that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present this. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you have at your convenience.
Any questions from the members? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the report. I've been anxious to see how this is going. Located in my community, of course, is the Minnesota Valley Food Hub, and appears, at least from my view, to be reasonably successful. And one of the keys they've accomplished is an ongoing contract with Gustavus Adolphus College. And I'm thinking that model is really appealing because it's a ready buyer. It's a buyer who wants to have high-quality food, locally sourced food for their students and the public. And, of course, the food hub is able to provide that service to the college. Have you seen other arrangements similar to that, or did you look at any other ways to for the institutional connections, hospitals, whoever's producing food or creating, you know, preparing food for multiple numbers of people, you know, kind of more in an institutional way? Are there any opportunities there?
Mr. Hu.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that's a great question, and I think one of the things that the Mankato Food Hub has in its favor is that connection to Gustavus Adolphus, and that's an institution that has the ability to work creatively with them and to be able to provide at least a margin that's reasonable for them to make that food hub function. Another example would be the food hub that's kind of in northwestern Minnesota, and it's actually a part of the Lakes Country Service Cooperative, which is one of the service cooperatives that serves independent school districts in a 9-county area. And so the nice thing with them is they already have a customer base, they already have all the logistics, the accounting, all of those kinds of infrastructure needs that can really sneak up on somebody in terms of what it costs to establish a business. And so they are serving school districts with local foods. And so there are models where you can do that. The caveat that I would say is that some of the institutional purchasers like that are dealing in a system where they have to award contracts based on competitive bidding, which makes it difficult for a food hub that generally has a higher cost of inputs anyway to compete for that business. Now, some districts are being very, very good and creative about giving themselves latitude to carve out a piece of their main contract and dedicate that to local purchases. So, yeah, it's not all doom and gloom. We just wanted to make sure that the realistic picture is available. But there are examples of how people can creatively find higher margin markets in their area.
Representative Johnson.
Thanks. I'd just like to follow up. I thought the competitive bidding obstacle is interesting. Is there any way within that to distinguish the locally sourced foods as perhaps distinct from other source foods so that the competitive bidding, you would actually be buying it, considered to buy a different product? Is there any room to move that way?
Mr. Hogan.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, I think that there is, and I think you know, one of the organizations we work with closely in terms of farm to school is the Minnesota School Nutrition Association, and they do a really good job of educating their members about the rules and regulations of the purchasing requirements that the state and also USDA and federal government have. And what we're seeing is that the most creative, innovative food service directors are, in fact, finding creative ways to do that. In some cases, it's building into their contract a percentage of that master contract that they can carve out and source locally. In other cases, what it is their mainline distributor working with maybe a local food hub or working with local producers to provide that market. One quick example of where we're seeing that work in a really innovative, effective way is with Minneapolis Public School Systems are working with Russ Davis Wholesale, which is their big provider. And Minneapolis Public Schools is big enough that they can compel a response to their request. So Russ Davis Wholesale, in response to that, is working with, among other things, the Hmong American Farming Association to source locally grown products from farmers who typically would not be big enough to sell into Russ Davis Wholesale. It's a very time and labor intensive mission, a lot of educating, a lot of working on food safety requirements to get them into the standards that Russ Davis has, but it is working and it is successful.
Excuse me, I'll officially call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Johnson, you have a follow-up.
Thank you.
You mentioned the Hmong American Farm, South St. Paul. That is, I went out there. Well, actually, Representative Clark and I were out there. We toured that. It's fascinating. Are you seeing more and more of farms or entities like that starting to pop up around the state as well? Is that unique?
Mr. Chairman, Representatives, yes, it's difficult to put a number on it, but there's a lot of interest in that from purchasers, both regular and consumers, as well as institutions who want to develop partnerships with, whether it's HAFA, whether it's, you know, name your organization that's creative, that's working with smaller scale producers. There's a great deal of interest. That there's a lot of challenges with it, and it's very much a relationship that requires cooperation and give and take and learning about learning about each other. What do you need? What do I need as the producer? But there is momentum, and we're seeing more of those conversations take place.
Excellent. Any other questions for the testifiers?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give us, do you have an update on the grants, like if the RFP was sent out and if you have the number of applicants for the grant?
Representative Schultz, the RFP is being finalized right now. We wanted to make sure that the RFP was based on the complete, most detailed recommendations and data that came out of this report. So we will be publishing that. We'll also be talking to all the food hubs that were interviewed and making sure that we're accurate in how we're interpreting what the kind of the core needs are. But we feel now that we have a pretty substantial base of data to work with, so you'll be seeing that RFP shortly.
Representative Schultz, follow-up. Any other questions? That's fire. Seeing none, I want to thank you, Ms. Place. Thank you also. And next on the agenda, we will call up Representative Hansen. You want to come forward, Representative Hansen? And while Representative Hansen's making his way, do we have a motion to approve the minutes dated March 24th?
So.
Representative Schultz moves the minutes dated March 24th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. We also have minutes from March 23rd. We have a motion. Representative Bly moves the minutes of March 23rd. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Hansen, we did have an informational hearing on this, so if you want to just refresh the committee on your bill, we will ask Representative Bly. You want to move the bill?
Sure. I move the House File 2408 be referred to the Committee on Agriculture and Finance.
So we have the bill before us. Representative Bly has moved the bill. We have the bill before us. Representative Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bly for moving the bill. And Mr. Chair, I know occasionally you recognize folks from the districts, and I was wondering maybe if we recognize someone from Representative Bly's district who is shadowing me today, who's with the Capital Pathways Program. So Adrian Benjamin, if you want to stand up and is here.
So, very nice. Mr. Benjamin earlier, very impressive. So thanks for joining us here today and job shadowing Representative Hansen. So to your bill, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is House File 2408 relates to emerald ash borer suppression. And those of us who are old enough remember Dutch elm disease and the massive response that we had as a state relating to Dutch elm disease. Emerald ash borer has been here in the legislature, I think started taking action in 2009. When we invested $2 million of Outdoor Heritage Fund. But since then, we've kind of dropped the ball. But the bugs keep coming. And I think if you remember back to the informational hearing, we saw the impacts in communities around the state if emerald ash borer takes a hold here. And so I've had some questions about why is this with the Department of Agriculture rather than DNR. Department of Agriculture deals with emerging invasive species. DNR deals with them after they're established. So I know there's money involved in this, but there's policy as well. And at the last hearing, you know, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you know that I'm somewhat skeptical on some pesticide use, but this is a tool that we will need to use along with many other tools relating to holding emerald ash borer until we can get reforestation and other responses to this. We need to have more diversity in our treescape throughout the state so that not only with emerald ash borer but also other pests that may be coming. So that resiliency comes from diversity and we need that to happen. So I would encourage your support to move it on to the to your committee.
Wonderful. Any questions for Representative Hansen? Seeing none, is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? No. Seeing none as well. Representative Bly, you want to renew your motion?
I renew my motion that House File 2408 be referred to the Committee on Agricultural Finance.
Thank you. Representative Bly renews his motion that House File 2408 will be re-referred to Ag Finance.
Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
We'll see you at the next committee, Representative Hansen. All right.
Hope it's that
right? I hear the chair is a pretty good guy, so, yeah. Am I the only one that laughed at that joke? All right. I think what we'll do, Representative Clark, are you ready?
Yes.
All right, so we'll ask Representative Clark to come on, and I believe you have some testifiers. Representative Clark, you want to move your bill?
Well, not on this committee, Mr. Chairman, so.
You're not?
I'm on your committee.
So. I'll move that House File 3324 be re-referred to the Committee on Agricultural Finance.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schultz. We have the bill before us. Representative Clark, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I'm really excited to bring this bill before you. This is the Urban Agriculture Development Pilot Program bill. And as you may recall, when this bill was before the Finance Committee, with you as chair, Ms. Representative Hamilton, we did pass language that created the words urban agriculture for the first time in Minnesota agriculture policy, Minnesota state law. And so that, and I believe we were first in the nation to do that, so I'm really proud that we made that step. And one of the other things that that language in the end did was to ask the Department of Agriculture to go around and help talk to stakeholders all over the state about what urban agriculture meant, what was a definition, what were some of the resources it needed, and how would it work, and that sort of thing. So what I have for you today is a bill that really carries out what the stakeholders and so on decided they wanted to have in an urban agriculture bill. There were numerous hearings, and I think it's an excellent bill. There's a few little amendments that I was talking with Mr. Sullivan about that we probably want to put on in your committee, Mr. Chairman, when it comes there, just to clarify a couple of things. One of them brought to me by the League of Cities, one of them just an oversight that I saw. So if we could, I'd like to have this room has got lots and lots of urban farmers in it, and I would like to have testimony from, there's just five different individuals that are groups that will be coming. I've told them they got 2 minutes, so we'll see if we can kind of hold to that.
Okay.
The story is big, but we really want to start introducing it here. And then when we come to your committee, I hope, I don't know, a week or two, that we'll be able to finish up with some funding. We know today is to talk about policy.
All right.
Thank you.
Clark, we'd love to hear from your testifiers. Who would you like to bring forth first? Representative Clark, if you can just kind of help us with the order, that
yep.
would be...
I think I gave that to Mr. Neisel.
Okay. So if you could please state your name for the record.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nadia Burnish. I am the program director at an organization called Gardening Matters that supports urban agriculture in the form of community gardens and backyard gardens. I'm also the chair of the St. Paul Ramsey County Food and Nutrition Commission, which is a board that works on food access issues in St. Paul Ramsey County.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'd like to talk a little bit first about our food system and where urban agriculture fits in our food system. And some of you may be familiar with the Minnesota Food Charter. The Minnesota Food Charter was developed and introduced about a year and a half ago, and it is a collaborative process. Yes, please pass them out. It was developed through a very collaborative process with intense community stakeholder feedback around what is needed to improve the food system in our state. And it is a roadmap of strategies to do just that. So in this document, there are 99 strategies that have been vetted by a number of audiences. And one of the strategies that you'll find in the food charter is recognizing the importance of urban agriculture to increase the capability for us to produce foods in and our increase the resiliency of our food system in the state of Minnesota. The report that the Department of Agriculture did that some of you are also, I'm sure, familiar with really highlighted the things that we have put into this bill, and this bill has really been a collaborative process also. I really want to emphasize that this is a bill that has been really vetted by the people. We've done a number of feedback sessions, and it's been feedback sessions that have been around the state. We've worked with our local extension offices to solicit feedback from stakeholders around the state, around this urban agriculture bill. So it's not just the Twin Cities. I really want to emphasize that it's populations that are greater than 10,000. So there are a lot of cities, there are almost 100 in Minnesota, that will qualify for this funding. So we've been working on this bill for a really long time. You're going to hear from a number of people that have been working on it for 3 or 4 years. Mr. Cheney, you'll hear from later, who's been one of the key leaders in moving this forward. And I really want to emphasize that now is the time to actually put some funding behind it. Minnesota is one of the leaders in agriculture, and we have the opportunity right now to be a leader in urban agriculture as well. And what we're really talking about with urban agriculture is some of the things that Mr. Hoogenen was talking about. We're really talking about small-scale production of fruits and vegetables and perhaps things like honeybees or mushrooms, things that are really appropriate for small-scale production and can be really productive on a small scale in areas where there's more population density. So I just want to highlight a couple of the benefits of urban agriculture from the perspectives from where I sit. The biggest one is the potential to produce food locally close to where people live. And that's really critical in increasing our resiliency as a state, making sure that we are producing food here rather than needing to import food from other places. We have a lot of capacity to produce more here locally. And urban agriculture is really a complement to our rural agriculture system. The two work hand in hand together. We know that urban agriculture has tremendous power to increase economic development in our areas, to build community in our areas, to work with youth development in our areas, to improve our environmental footprint in our urban areas. So the list of benefits is long. And so there are a lot of stories that we're going to hear today. I'm going to turn the microphone over to Jean Pao, who will talk about some of that.
So please state your name for the record and begin.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sean Powell Lee. Everybody calls me XP, so you're welcome to do so.
Mr. XP?
Yes. Right. Mr. XP. I am the community coordinator for Frogtown Farm. We are a small urban farm for about 5 acres right in the heart of Frogtown, St. Paul. We are actually part of St. Paul's newest park, which is Frogtown Park and Farm. So we're really excited about the opportunities there. This is our first growing season. Everybody that we've talked to is super excited about having this resource that's not only a green space, but also an urban farm, you know, available to them and right in their community. I started as a community coordinator about 6 months ago, back in September. Since then, I've gained so many friends, you know, I would call, you know, family members who have worked in this arena for a very long time. I'm happy to join them. I've also lost about 20 pounds, you know, being inspired and just invigorated by the movement that is represented here today. You know, people are calling, people are wanting to partner up with us as an organization, but also the residents, you know, are looking for a way, you know, where they can grow their own vegetables. You know, they'd be willing to pay for a plot if we had it for them, but we don't. Our model is a communal model that supports our vision and our mission of enriching the world by cultivating soil and community in Frogtown, by recruiting neighbors into more of a team of maybe 30 or 40 to work on our communal farm, which is about an acre of our 5 acres, to be able to grow and learn together and have skill shares together, and then they will have a share of their crops at the end of the season. So we're really excited about all of the opportunities that we will provide into our community, our neighborhood, the city of St. Paul, and the state of Minnesota, and that's why we're here supporting this bill with Nadia and Representative Clark.
So thank you.
Thank you very much.
XP, are you seeing where the children, the youth, are taking an interest in this as well?
Yes, we have a lot of partnerships, and we're working with Youth Farm. We're working with a lot of college students. We're working. I just tabled at Obama Elementary and Jackson Elementary to really try and get the parents and the staff involved. And the response, again, has been just overwhelmingly positive and just excitement, you know, everywhere about getting involved with this new resource.
And my other question, do you have any 4-H or FFA clubs established as well to get these children involved into?
That's something not yet. Not yet at the farm. But we will. We'll be looking for some kind of youth club in partnership with other organizations in the area. So definitely youth, you know, children, you know, young adults, all the way up to seniors. You know, we're looking for to get everybody involved. We want to build a really broad-based coalition of support.
Yeah, well, XP, that's one of the areas that I'm passionate about as well, as far as these youth programs. And 4-H is a very good program. FFA is a very good program. And I'd like to work with Representative Clark. We can help get those established.
That would be great. We'd love to work with you.
All right, wonderful. Chair. Wonderful. Thank you. Any other questions for the testifier at this time? All right.
I just have one more comment that, I mean, XP raised a tremendous point that this bill addresses, and that's the addressing of the disparities that we face. This bill indicates 50% of the funds will go to communities of color and tribal communities. And so one of the main strengths of this bill is that it's addressing the disparities that we're seeing in our community related to health and to food access. So I just want to make sure that I point that out and other speakers will talk about
it. Thank you. Wonderful. And as XP testified, it's a great program to lose weight as well. So I tease a little bit. We like to have fun in this committee. Representative Clark, your next testifier, please.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to hear you hear from Joanna Hill.
Ms. Hill, please state your name for the record, if you would, please.
Hi. Good morning. My name is Joanna Hill. I'm an enrolled member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, a Native American reservation in Minnesota. And I have, so I'm here to testify on behalf of the Mashkikigitigan, which in Anishinaabe or Ojibwe means medicine garden. I have been participating in the weekly classes and workshops that are offered free of charge by the Mashkikigitigan for about over 2 years. And I also grew up in the Phillips neighborhood where the Mashkikigitigan is located. This little urban farm, Mashkikigitigan, has proven to be an invaluable resource to the communities, the diverse communities that reside here, to the Native American population, the Latino, Somali, African American, and all of the cultural backgrounds that are a part of this diverse neighborhood. The Mashkikigitigan holds weekly classes for both adults and children. There's a 4-H garden club for the youth in a grow-your-own class where we can learn about nutrition, healthy eating, how to grow our own food, where we share healthy meals together, and where we learn from various teachers in the community on a wide range of topics pertaining to organic gardening, environmentally sustainable techniques, food preservation, food justice issues, seed keeping, and where we're even able to come together to share our cultural knowledge about food and plants. The Mashkikigitigan organically grows over 80 varieties of fruits, vegetables, herbs, mushrooms, and flowers. And it's also been a part of, just recently, the Four Sisters Farmers Market, which also is located in the heart of the Phillips neighborhood.
You did good.
The Mashkikigitigan, I'm here to share with you today that it has really touched my life a lot. It has empowered our community with the resources to live more vibrant, joyful, and healthy lives. And it also has become an important bridge linking all of our communities together, all age groups, all nationalities. And this neighborhood has grown tremendously since the urban 24th Street urban farm, or the Mashkikigitigan, has been here. And so I'm here to ask you to please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hill. Ms. Hill, myself and Chair Anderson and Representative Clark, we toured some various urban farms, and we went to a medicine garden. Would this be the one that you're affiliated with as well, Ms. Hill?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
it
is.
This
is the one.
It is, Mr. Chairman. If I remember, the market was going on, and you bought a few things.
I did. I was hungry. It was very good. It was impressive. So, thank you, Ms. Hill. We do have a question, Representative Nornes.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess this would be for Representative. $20 million is the request, right?
It is.
That seems like a pretty hefty amount. Mm-hmm. Of that. In the bill, it doesn't appear that there's any limitations on the size of those grants. How will that be determined? In other words, you could have several or one entity get the entire amount. So are you looking at possible limits to the size of those grants?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That has not been a part of the legislation at this point. It could be something that when we get to the Finance Committee, we could talk a little more about. But let me just point out, it is a significant amount of money. And the reason for it is, I think, just what we heard from both of our speakers so far. Part of what we're trying to do is address some of the racial disparities that happen to our communities, the whole state, because of lack of healthy food access. And so the programs that are the packages that have been talked about in terms of that have included a lot of other economic development issues and so on. And we wanted to make sure that urban agriculture was part of that because it is one of the ways that we can really address the issues, obesity, learning issues, all kinds of things that have to do, economic opportunities that have to do with being able to have good, healthy food. So we realize it's a significant amount. And I think your idea to maybe set some limits might be a good idea. One of the things that if you look at the legislation is a competitive system, and it's a pilot, and it has, I think, 20 different criteria that will have to be met or that will be used as ranking, I should say, for the grants. So at this point, we don't have an upper limit, but I'm thinking you're probably going to be giving me a good idea. Maybe we should think about that. If you look at that list, you'll see that it really does favor trying to make sure that we're serving low-income people, communities of color, really effective farming, urban farming techniques and so on.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I apologize if I got into finance, but I just couldn't wait with the questions. So I'm here.
That's okay.
That's all right, Representative Nornes. And we're committed to work with Representative Clark on this as well. The next stop would be the Finance Committee.
I was just going to put in a little plug for the community I live in. We have a community garden, which is kind of on the same order, but it's a different setting than where you're located. And it's easy to find people that will probably donate the site, and then we have people that volunteer, including the hospital and all, so it becomes a community event. It's gotten to be very successful, very large, but it's done strictly because the community decided they wanted to do that. So,
in Fergus Falls, are we talking about?
Clark.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I just have to say Muskegee is a very good example of just what you're talking about. It's become a community gathering place, right? And it's just a celebration when people come there. Right. And I imagine that's some of what's going on with your... I'd like to hear more about that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Allen.
Oh, wait a minute.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for or either one of you. As far as it looks like one of the criteria for selection is to increase urban agricultural production capacity. Do you see these programs... is it about building a food, in this booklet here, is about building a food infrastructure? So we, from growing to processing to distributing, because I see that in our community that we have a lot of good urban agriculture and that, and then we do have some commercial kitchens available for processing. They're sometimes really expensive, mm-hmm. but distributing it to those in need or food shelves and hopefully replacing the food shelves at some point so that everybody's engaged in growing and producing food is how I see the vision. But can you talk a little bit about how this leads to increasing distribution?
Okay, I'll start. Well, yes, absolutely. And I know that you've been committed to that issue too. So one of the things that's happening, for example, at Muskegee Gitagon that's happening at each of the other urban farms is that there is education and training going on, first of all, so that people learn how to do this kind of farming. And so the food hubs that were being talked about earlier, that's one of the things that can come out of some of these systems, some of these actual farming groups. And there's a couple of commercial kitchens that have been developed with food hubs in that in mind, and I'm thinking of one that maybe we'll hear a little bit more about when we hear from Hafa in a few minutes, but there's a place called the Good Acre where farmers who are mostly urban farmers, are related to urban farming and others, are bringing the food. They're able to have facilities that are affordable to actually process, clean the food, market it in a joint way in some situations. So there's a lot of work to be done yet to actually make that vision come true. And I think it's part of what some of these grants would be going for. I'm hoping that some of the farmers will actually apply to develop those kinds of facilities or have more access to them. Sometimes they cost a little bit, and some of those costs could be borne maybe in some of the grants. I know that the classes that are happening at Meshkigi Gitagon, for example, are preparing people just for that. I don't know if you want to say anything more about that.
Ms. Hill?
So Meshkigi also has interns that are learning. And so, you know, there's just a lot of opportunities that has developed in the last, you know, couple of years for everybody to learn more and to do those kinds of things. So,
Representative Allen, follow up? Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Hill at this time? See none? Representative Clark, you're next.
Mr. Chairman, yes, if I could call Michael Cheney, and I think he has two other people with him. Oh, it looks like more than two.
Well, Mr. Cheney.
Well, we can at least get two on board.
Welcome to the committee. And you know, 2 days in a row there, Mr. Cheney.
I think so, I should run for politics.
Right?
Getting comfortable up here.
Please state your name for the record, if you would, please. And
Michael Cheney, Project Sweetie Pie.
Welcome.
I want to just point out, I got our new buttons. Project Sweetie Pie will work for food. So I'm glad to see that today seems to be, we've come a long ways over the last 3-4 years, and it's glad to see not only the urban farm efforts, but the kind of the convergence of all this thought, you know, folks, in terms of food access and the food hubs, and all of which is the work that really we've been trying to employ and deploy over the last 4 or 5 years. So I'm glad to applaud the state of Minnesota, the Ag, because I think that we're really, really doing something here that's really going to transform what agriculture means in the nation, and certainly here in local Minneapolis. So I handed out to each of you a thing that I call the Village of North Minneapolis, the Nile of the North. And the reason I wanted to share that with you is because oftentimes people like to relegate urban farming to some young kids working in a garden, growing some onions and tomatoes. Isn't that cute? But that's never been really our vision of what we see. You know, we've really seen, from the very onset of this, we've really seen that urban farming is a way to really bring communities together. And so we're not referring to North Minneapolis now as this organization or that. We're really working together with a lot of the organizations there and really referring to it as the Village of North Minneapolis. And bringing some of those values of small town, middle America to really, how can we work together collectively to bring about transformation and change? And so as you see here in this chart, we've got community gardens, growing awareness, growing food. And those are some of the representative organizations, Youth Farm, Kwanzaa Church, Redeemer, Project Sweetie Pie, that are working at. It's basically been much the same as the tobacco movement. It's really been to grow the awareness and let everybody know that they are part of the community and that they are part of the solution, and they are not the problem. As long as we continue to look at residents, low-income residents, as the problem, then we are not part of the solution. We are part of the problem. At the same time that we started the garden project, we started a thing called the Youth Cafe, Youth-Led, Youth-Fed. Project Sweetie Pie wasn't a nonprofit at that time, so we took it to Oak Park Neighborhood Center, and we started a food program there called the Youth Cafe that now went to Cargill, went to General Mills, got funding, and now does community meals 3 times a week. In the third, and they're growing skills, growing products. Because if young kids in North Minneapolis, if in South Minneapolis, if all they get out of this farm-to-school money is another a lettuce or a carrot, then once again, residents in those communities have been shortchanged. We can't be responsible for what's happened in the past, but all of us here today are responsible for what happens in the future. And so I join each and every one of you here to help me in the creation, help all of us in this room in terms of creating a more equitable society. The greenhouse on Dowling and Humboldt, we like to refer to it as the Arboretum of the North, the cookie cart on steroids, because it creates a whole opportunity to really link all of the neighborhood organizations in our community and bringing people forward. So we've worked in partnership with the university. We just got a $50,000 grant to do proof of concept. And we're looking at 4 areas. We're looking at horticulture, greenhouse maintenance and management. We're looking at soil science and composting. We're looking at aquaponics, and we're looking at STEM curriculum. How can we take all of this collective thought, all of this collective wealth that we have in these communities, and instead of having people who aren't part of the American dream, how can they bring them into this free enterprise system? And communities that have historically been programmed to be consumers, it's incumbent on each and every one of us that we bring them into the free enterprise system, and that we see every resident from young to old as part of the people who are going to bring about solutions. So I brought a few people here that have been stalwart champions, and Adam Pruitt here, first of all.
Thank you, Mr. Cheney. And if you'd please state your name for the record and begin, if you would.
Hello. My name is Adam Pruitt. Thank you for allowing me to be up here. It's nice to see everybody here and see that people are in support of trying to get things done for a healthier community. Long time ago, a few years back actually, I was an intern under Michael Cheney's mentorship in the gardens, and shortly after that, I had kind of branched off and started doing something different thanks to his help. He showed me to the correct people because I wanted to start getting fresh and affordable produce into the corner stores within North and South Minneapolis, because I noticed there are so many of them, but none of them have any healthy options. And he had partnered me with my colleague here, Adam Kay from the University of St. Thomas, and Collie Graddick from the from Community Table. So we formed what we have now called Brightside, as I'm wearing the shirt. And we've been up and running for about 2 years now. We've managed to become financially sustainable. However, we have some struggles that we do run into, such as trying to get our own means for transportation. Currently, we use a vehicle from the University of St. Thomas. We would like to expand and do more stores. We started out with about 8, and now we have 15 that we service every Saturday. And what we do basically is we will buy produce from a distribution center out in St. Paul. It's J&J's Distributing. And what we do is we will distribute it to corner stores and let them buy in the quantities that they want. If they want just one bunch of bananas, then that's what we give to them, you know, almost at wholesale pricing. All of our stores seem to love us. We recently did the University of Minnesota? Yeah, the University of Minnesota did a study on us and our stores that we service. And all of our stores seem to love us. They love our service and they love our produce. So that's basically, in a nutshell, that's kind of what we do. And we would like to take things further, be able to do more stores, be able to have more than just one day that we operate, and be able to hire more people. However, with the way that we've managed to become financially sustainable, it's not to a point where we're able to purchase our own vehicle or where we're able to hire our own people. So,
my name is Patsy Parker, and I'm a composter. And I'd like to turn your attention to page 17 of the Minnesota Food Charter, because there is a problem right there, which is their little diagram at the end of eating is dispose. And this, as far as I'm concerned, is a very incorrect statement. And the reality is, if we don't have compost, we don't have good soil. So learning how to do those full circle agricultural practices, to me, is one of the important things that needs to happen. I'm also a teacher, teaching. I'm working in North High with Michael and talking to all the high school kids and talking to them about food. Many of them eat cereal for dinner, cereal, ramen, or peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. One kid has not been to the supermarket for a year, and so we are really in the heart of talking to people about what they eat, how they eat, and trying to help people really understand how they, in their own lives, can start to eat very differently. So health is one of our big goals, and compost makes good soil, makes good gardens, and makes healthy people. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Parker. And Mr. Pruitt, did you have a follow-up, or is it Mr. Kay? You were starting to lean up as well.
Yeah, so I'm a professor at the University of St. Thomas, and I just wanted to highlight the work that Adam Pruitt has done. He's 18 years old. He started this work when he was 16, and it's really this work of inspiring entrepreneurship in young people. And so what they've accomplished is they've been able to bring fresh produce to corner stores in low-income neighborhoods. This is a national problem. Nobody's been able to figure this out, and they've done it. And they've done it by creating this connection to more affluent communities, because they sell all the leftovers from the corner store runs to people in small shares, and they mark that up more. And so combining that together, bringing people together, has allowed them to really address this problem. And I think this is a scalable model. I think this bill sounds fantastic because it would provide some seed money to be able to help make things scalable. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you so much. Mr. Chairman, I know we're getting short on time, but I would like to ask Paku Hang to come next, and then maybe right on board Tim Page and Chair.
Mr. Pruitt, while she's coming down, are you seeing an interest with the youth? Are they starting to see an interest more in agriculture and being involved as well?
Yes, so far with the people that I have brought on board and have had involved within the program, they've been kind of close friends and family so far, just to see how things work out. But nobody's had any issues, and everybody seemed to have worked real well with the entire program, and they love it. They come back every Saturday.
Wonderful. So, thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you for your time.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. My name is Paku Hang, spelled P-A-K-O-U-H-A-N-G. I'm the executive director of the Hmong American Farmers Association. I'm also a member of the Minneapolis Food Council, and I'm the child of farmers. I've been farming for 30-plus years, and I just feel really honored to be here and to speak with you all. Before I begin, I do want to do a special thank you to Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, and Representative Clark. They have been such amazing and really thoughtful supporters among Hmong farmers, and so I just really appreciate that. I want to lift you both up. Thank you. So what I'd like to do today is I'd like to tell you a little bit about my organization and the farmers that we work with, who I think will be great beneficiaries of this bill. And I'd like to share with you some stories of why I think this bill, and especially the funds that would allow organizations like mine to provide technical assistance to farmers, is so critical when we talk about local food production and really just healthy living for Minnesotans. So my organization, again, is called the Hmong American Farmers Association, also known as HAFA, that's the acronym. And we are not a direct service organization, so we are membership-based organization. We work with over 128 Hmong farmers. We work with them to build their own capacity so they can be self-sufficient. We work with them to help them access land, to access capital and credit, to access alternative markets besides the farmers market, to access training, and to access research opportunities. The typical Hmong farmer is someone who lives in the urban area but farms in the first ring suburbs, what many urban planners call the green belt. Right. On average, my farmers are about 60 years old. They're married. They own their own homes. They have children who are in at least one child, if not all the children, who are engaged in higher education. These are people who not only own their homes, they have cars. They're active members. They're participating members of our community. And so there's something stabilizing about Hmong farmers that differ from other Hmong families. Something about farming that makes them, whether it's financial stability or whether it's the fact that farmers' families are working together, that creates a lot of robust social capital that makes these families more stable. Hmong families, you know, we know that in Minnesota we are national leaders around corn and soybean production, really international leaders. And that's something that I think I'm really proud of, and I think we should be really proud of as well. But what you may not know is that in Minnesota we are also national leaders around local food production. Our farmers markets, the St. Paul farmers market, the Minneapolis farmers markets, are continuously logged, whether it's the top 10, the number one or top 10 farmers market in the country. We were pioneered back even as early as the 70s around local food production. And a lot of this has been because of Hmong farmers. Based on HAFA's study, longitudinal study starting in 2011, Hmong farmers account for more than 50% of all the farmers in the metropolitan area farmers market. And so for folks who may not be familiar with Hmong people, I just want to give you a quick if you'll indulge me, just a quick history lesson. Hmong people are political refugees. They're indigenous to parts of southern China and Southeast Asia. During the Vietnam War, they allied with the United States. And when the Vietnam War ended and the communist faction in Laos came into power, the communist faction began to specifically target Hmong families because they felt that we had allied with the United States. And so there was a huge exodus of Hmong people from Laos to leave Laos. And many Hmong families were able to be resettled all around the world. So there are Hmong people now in Argentina, in Australia, in Denmark, you know, who knew Hmong people in Denmark, in French Guiana. And then we have a large population in the United States, and specifically in Minnesota. And this is really to, you know, to folks like Catholic Charities and Lutheran Social Services who are sponsoring Hmong families. But when many Hmong families came to the United States, like my parents, they didn't have the skills for this new economy. And the skills that they did have was farming. And so thanks to great leadership from the University of Minnesota Extension, they intentionally reached out to farmers market managers in St. Paul and Minneapolis and said, why don't you work with some of these Hmong farmers, have them become farmers with you guys? And since then, you know, the farmers markets have only gotten better and better. But we are seeing that even though Hmong farmers are working really hard and they're contributing a lot to the local economy and to the local food economy specifically, for every acre the Hmong families grow, they're only making about $5,000 an acre, compared to mainstream Minnesota vegetable growers who are making a minimum $8,000 an acre. Right, so there's really a great disparity between what Hmong farmers are making and what mainstream Minnesota farmers are making. And Hmong farmers are growing between 5 to 15 acres. So these are not your backyard farmers. And these are people who are relying on farming for their main, if not their sole, livelihoods. These are business people, right? And yet they're still not making it. And so that's why this bill, I think, is so important. And I want to share with you three stories that I think get to that point. The first story is that, you know, as any small business owner, you know that insurance is really, really important. And as farmers, we get our, because we don't do corn and soybean, we get our business, we get our farming insurance from a program called NAPS, and it's a federal program. it's specifically for specialty crops. And from HAFA's perspective, based on our survey, we think there's about 500 Hmong families in Minnesota that do farming for their main livelihood, right? Last year, according to the Farm Service Agency, only 6 Hmong families applied for crop insurance. That's less than, you know, 2%. Right, of the pool of Hmong farmers that we think. I don't think that's sustainable. Because of funding this year, we were able to provide technical assistance to the farmers who are part of our membership. We doubled that number to 14 Hmong farmers, which I still think is really atrocious. That's only 3%, right? But that just goes to the magnitude of how technical assistance can contribute to really changing people's lives. And any business owner knows you have to think about your risk assessment and you have to have insurance. The fact that our farmers don't have insurance is not because they're not, it's not because they're dumb and thinking, oh, I don't need crop insurance. It's because the barriers to get that type of specialty crop insurance is so hard. So that's one story I wanted to share. Another story I wanted to share is, you know, so we, I think Karen alluded to this, we have run a food hub, the Hmong American Farm Association. We run a food hub, and we, on behalf of our farmers, go out and get these contracts for our farmers. We aggregate our, we train our farmers on food safety, post-harvest handling, and then we aggregate our farmers' produce, and we sell to all these different institutions. And one of the institutions, which is a good institution, the local retailer, they wanted to buy Brussels sprouts from our farmers. And they would only sell, they would only buy our Brussels sprouts for $1.50. Right? So if anybody has ever grown Brussels sprouts, that's crazy low price. And we worked with Ridgewater College, which is one of the few colleges in the Minsky system that still has a farm business management program. We worked intensely with some of their instructors to do break-even analysis, basically the cost of production of what a Brussels sprout, what a pound of Brussels sprout would cost. And it costs over $4. So we could have, if we didn't have that access to technical assistance, we wouldn't have been able, we would have sold our, you know, Brussels sprouts to this good-meaning retailer, but we would totally be paying them for our labor, right? And so because of that analysis, we're now saying, okay, we're going to produce Brussels sprouts, but we're going to sell them at a level just for certain high-end restaurants and not for a wholesale or retail market, right? That decision-making would have been able to be done if we did not have access to technical assistance. And then last but not least, I just wanted to talk about land access. And I want to share a story. Many of our farmers farm, they live in the Twin Cities, but they farm in like Washington County or Dakota County. And for a long time, many of our farmers rented land from a white farmer in Dakota County. And this white farmer said, I will rent land to you at $300 an acre, which is still very high in this area, $300 an acre. But you have to allow for my family to come on the land whenever they want to and take whatever they want free of charge. The farmers had to do this. They had to agree to that stipulation in addition to the fee to get access to this land. And one thing that Hoffa is doing is that we're working with our farmer. Right now we have a, Mr. Chair, you alluded to this, we have a farm, 155-acre farm, which we sublease 5 and 10-acre parcels to our farmers. And we are modeling what it means to be to have good land stewardship. What does it mean to use cover crops? What does it mean to do crop rotation, to intercropping? What does it mean to actually run a farm? You know, what are the overhead costs? What is the cost to run a, to have a well? So that one day, if our farmers can be on this land and understand it, when they're ready and they have their finances are in good order and they go and buy their own farm, they can have a greater probability of success than if they were just to do it by themselves. So these are just some of the stories, I think, and some of the reasons why access to this fund and the technical assistance can come from this fund is so important to this community. So thank you.
Well, Paku, or excuse me, Ms. Hang, I've known Paku for a while now, and I wish I had half your energy. I'll just say that right now. I wish I had half your energy. But, you know, you shared the story about the Hmong, and this is quite remarkable, everything. I had a wonderful opportunity to travel to Laos with a Hmong delegation, and they shared with me. And one of the things that stuck with me is my dear friend said, Rod, you know what, we're farmers by nature. And if you think about what happened after the Vietnam War, you know, pulled out of Laos and in that area and plopped in their words, not mine. They said the concrete jungles of Minneapolis, St. Paul, Green Bay, Wisconsin, Fresno, California. And they said, we're farmers by nature. Yeah. And so, you know, this is exciting that these things are happening. And I'm just happy that we're a part of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for the testifier? Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. We can tell your enthusiasm, and just amazing.
Thank you.
As a corn and soybean guy, I would be very happy with $5,000 an acre, but that's a different story.
No, totally.
We've talked before, talking about operating a farm, you know, takes some upfront capital, those kind of things, and we've talked about Hmong farmers being able to access the capital. You didn't mention that. What about the situation of getting an operating loan? How do you deal with that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a wonderful question. And it has changed drastically in the five years that we started HAFA. We have great support from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, from USDA to and Farm Service Agency to get these micro loans that farmers can access loans and be able to, you know, start buying a tractor and then maybe eventually land. But I want to share one story. So, you know, these loans are available. But for the first couple of years, many Hmong farmers were not accessing these loans. And the former Assistant Commissioner, Charlie Poster, said, Paku, this is what you said your farmers needed. How come no one is accessing these funds? And when we investigated further, we found out that in order to get some of these loans, you had to have a business plan. You had to have been keeping farm records, right? You have been filing Schedule F. And our farmers weren't doing that because many of the technical services were all in English. So you had someone who could help you write a business plan, but it was all in English. And you had someone who could maybe help you figure out your taxes, but that was English and they weren't Hmong. And so the value added of an organization like HAFA is that we're Hmong, we're speaking Hmong, we understand the cultural dynamics, so we can help them, you know, fill out the Schedule F form, create a business plan so they can qualify for these loans. So for me, the lesson was we can think these are great solutions, but that was like step 10, and our farmers were still at step 2. And they couldn't make that leap. And I think that's why this technical assistance that a fund like this and this bill would offer is so critical. Because we know that good people, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the USDA, there are good things out there happening, but it's that gap that we have to bridge.
Chair Anderson. All right. Representative Clark, we're going to wrap this up within 5 to 7 minutes.
Right.
Okay?
Okay. I have just one more
yes, please,
testifier, and I just would like to have them speak because they're going to speak to one part of the bill.
Absolutely.
Thank you,
Ms. Hang.
They're going to speak to a part of the bill that you'll notice that one of the what's been talked about a lot is that tenure, land tenure, and the issue of being able to actually be able to count on the land that you have designated. So they're going to, I think, talk a little bit about that and let them introduce themselves. And it's one of the more reasons why we need this bill.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Wonderful. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Jerry Flowers, and I've been involved in urban agriculture for about the last 10 years here in the Twin Cities, working with a nonprofit organization, having our own businesses together, and now working for Frogtown Farm. So we've had a variety of different experiences in urban agriculture, and we wanted to speak today in support of this bill for a couple of reasons. One, because we feel that funding is so important. It really shows that we value urban agriculture, basically put our money where our mouth is. The other thing that we think is really important is that it recognizes agriculture as an important use of land, where that has not always been the case. It also recognizes the need for land security, which allows the farmer to invest in the infrastructure that they need to make their farm viable, and it also allows them to build the soil, which is what's going to make healthy food. We've had the experience of, we farmed at North End, which was a 3-acre parcel on Maryland Avenue, for about 3 years, and it was owned at that time by a nonprofit organization. In the middle of the third year, the city reclaimed that land from that nonprofit, and the farmers who were us on one end, Stones were on the other end, and then another group in the middle, were all told that those leases would not be renewed and that the land would then be used for affordable housing. And in fact, that land is still vacant, but no one is farming it. You know, plans are, I'm sure, going forward. Anyway, so, you know, at North End, we had actually installed a deer fence. We had installed a hoop house, a high tunnel, 30 by 72 structure to extend the season. And so those were things that, you know, a year later we were taking back down again. And that had a significant impact on our business. It meant that we lost a half acre of production that was in the city. It was convenient for us. And it meant that we really redirected our attention from growing produce to doing value-added products, doing education, and doing more consulting work. And so that consulting work then eventually led us to doing soil building work for Frogtown Farm. And then I'll let Tim talk about Frogtown Farm a little more.
Thank you.
Please, sir, state your name for the record and begin.
Tim Page, co-farm manager at Frogtown Farm.
And excuse me, your last name was Page?
Page, P-A-G-E.
All right, thank you so much.
I just wanted to speak to a couple things about what you said. I actually started a couple of 4-H clubs back in 2006. At Frogtown, we have a unique opportunity because we're in the middle. A preschool is on one side of the farm and another preschool is on the other side. And so people often walk through going to school and coming back. And we plan on taking advantage of that and doing community education. One thing with the farm, we have about 25% of it, which is dedicated to research and development. So on those spaces is where we'll have 4-H clubs. I actually used to say, I was talking to some kids and I said, we're going to do the STEAM curriculum. And they were like, that's old. We were going to do the STEM curriculum. And now they're doing STEAM. They added an A for arts. And so in the 25%.
Or Mr. Page, or agriculture.
Agriculture.
I like that.
I do. I'll have something different for them the next time. But in the 25% of the farm, we're going to split that up into areas the size of backyards. So when we do something around soil remediation, then we're going to be able to work with community members for them to duplicate it in their yards. And that's another way that Frogtown will make a good impact.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Mr. Page, for sharing about the 4-H, getting the kids involved, too. That's fantastic. So thank you. Any questions for the test? Ms. Flowers?
If I could just say, too, just to compare our experience at North End, where we really didn't have land permanence, the experience at Frogtown Farm is that we have an 8-year lease with the city and opportunity to have another 8-year lease. And so we're able to build this site into a permaculture site, which means we're planting food forests there. We're able to chase our organic certification, which is something you wouldn't bother with if you didn't have land tenure. So there are things that we can do there. We can build the soil there in a way that we couldn't do if we didn't have land tenure. So that's the difference.
All right, thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we're out of time, but I want to just say thank you. There's many people in this room who could tell stories, and I know there's other witnesses, but I know when we have your committee, we'll have a chance to do that. We're not going to do that today, but I thank you for this opportunity, and if there's any questions about the bill, I'd be glad to try to...
Well, Representative Clark, we do have one more testifier.
Oh, yes,
right?
We do.
So we have one more testifier, and we'll invite them down.
But I'd also like to say this is one of the coolest things. You know, it is. You know, and I'm just going to say it. I haven't seen this much color in this room for a long time, and it's beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm really happy to have Mrs. Stone speak with us. We talked about a potential amendment, and I think it's drafted for the your committee, and I'll let...
Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota Cities, and past president of the Cheerful Champs 4-H Club in Montevideo. So,
welcome.
Right.
That was a shameless plug.
Yeah, I just had to go with the theme of the day. Mr. Chair, I worked with the author. I'm very grateful for the efforts that Representative Clark and the chairs have put in on this for several years now. To make this a useful tool, as I think all of you are aware, and we heard from Representative Nornes and others, most communities are very interested in community gardening and are trying to do something in those regards, and many already are doing a lot of things in that regard. This program would just create a new tool and a new funding opportunity to make that easier and maybe more successful. So the League does support this grant program. I have worked with Representative Clark on Subdivision 3, which is the repayment section. And I just want to spend 1 minute, Mr. Chair, explaining Please. What we're fixing in that. What we will be addressing is the way that it is currently worded, it actually kind of sets up a permanent repayment, that if ever the land is used for another purpose, there would have to be a triple repayment of the grant amount. And that was not the intent of the legislation. So we will add language in both clauses that make it clear that for a period of 5 years after accepting a grant under this program, you have to repay if you change the use of the land during that time. And just make sure that that's the clear intent and that it's not setting up something where it's a disincentive to be in this program because you may need to use the land for something else sometime down the road and don't want to make it a permanent situation. So simply clarifying language to make it clear when you would have to repay. That's the only change that we've asked for.
And Mr. Chair, I'm fine with that. You probably noticed there is another place in the bill where we actually tried to say that on line 2.29, but this clarifies it and makes it clear.
Okay. All right. So, Representative Clark, we can work on that.
Yes, I accept that amendment.
All right. Wonderful.
And, Mr. Chairman, I forgot to say another organization that has indicated its support is Farmers Union. I want to just make sure. I know they're not able to testify today. We're out of time, but they do support this bill. And I'm guessing that if there might be some other organizations in the room that later want to give me their formal endorsement, I'll be glad to include it when we come to your committee, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Fantastic. Any other questions or comments? Otherwise, we're going to... All right. Seeing none. Who moved this bill? Representative Schultz, you want to renew your motion?
Yes, I renew my motion that House File 3324 be referred to the Committee on Agriculture Finance.
Representative Schultz renews her motion that House File 3324 will be referred to the Committee on Agriculture Finance. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Congratulations, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
I'm gonna have to find a different chair.
We have one more bill on the agenda, and I think it's just as interesting. Could we please have a little bit of a decorum and quiet in the committee room? We have one more bill on the agenda for today. And that is House File 3363, authored by Chair Hamilton. And as he makes his way up to the testifier table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I tried to run as fast as I could.
Take all the time you need. And so, Chair Hamilton, would you care to move your bill?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I will move House File 3363 to be referred to the House, where are we going? Ag Finance.
Gov.
Right? Okay.
Hey. And do you have an amendment that you would care to have the bill put in its proper fashion?
Not at this moment.
Okay.
All right. So what I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, if I could, in essence of time, we'll turn it over to... we want to do the A1 amendment right away? All right. I think what we'll do at this time is I'll turn it to the testifiers, and we'll just walk through the bill, get us familiar with the bill.
Good morning. Identify yourselves, and please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Callanan. I'm Regional Vice President of Advocacy for the American Heart Association, and I also chair the Minnesotans for Healthy Kids Coalition, which is a statewide coalition of about 25 organizations working on policies to address childhood obesity, so really supporting healthy eating and physical activity across the state. And so we are very grateful for Representative Hamilton introducing this bill for the Good Food Access Fund. We're excited to build some momentum behind this issue. I'm glad that the previous testifiers raised the Minnesota Food Charter, because the work that we're doing with this legislation very closely works within that Food Charter rubric. And so we're excited to put this idea forth. Representative Hamilton asked me to kind of walk through our goals with the legislation, so I'll do that quickly. And then we have two fantastic testifiers who are going to talk about, no pressure, they're going to talk about how this program would really work on the ground in Minnesota, in rural Minnesota in particular. So to quickly walk through the parameters of the bill and the program that we envision, our goal in coming together, the coalition talked to a number of stakeholders, probably hundreds of meetings and pieces of feedback from people about what should be included in a bill to ensure healthy food access in Minnesota. And some of the feedback we got was that we really felt that it should be housed, the new program should be housed at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, that they really had the expertise in Minnesota food systems, they had the experience and expertise in loans, grants, and technical assistance that were envisioned as part of this program. And so we really felt that they were the appropriate state agency to lead this program. So that's where the program would sit. Our goal is to establish the program with $10 million per year in general fund resources. And those resources would go out in the form of loans, grants, or technical assistance. And we heard a lot of feedback from folks around the state that technical assistance, for example, was really important, because while some, you know, grocery stores, convenience stores, organizations that might be able to help solve this problem have a desire to help solve the problem of healthy food access, they may not have the business expertise or the food handling expertise to be successful. So technical assistance was really an important part of this program. Loans would be a very key component, because a lot of the models out there require some financial assistance, but that money could be repaid and ideally recycled back into this program to be used on a future project. And then we heard that grants were very important, because some, especially nonprofits that are trying to help meet the needs on healthy food access, may not have the ongoing income to really be sustainable without some intense help kind of on the front end to get the program established or get what was needed up and running. So that's the broad overview. One of the key components of the program, too, is we ask that Department of Ag establish a working group of experts in the field who are actually working on these issues throughout Minnesota to really help inform creating the program criteria and guidelines and how this money would be distributed throughout the state to help address those healthy access food needs. So that's the broad overview. I'm happy to answer any questions. I know there's a lot of detail in the bill because we're establishing a new program, but we're really excited to move this forward, and I think it dovetails very nicely with the previous bill. It's very complementary about talking about Minnesota's food system and our focus, of course, with the Minnesota or with the American Heart Association, our goal is healthy food access. But a lot of the stakeholders we've talked to, the focus is economic development and getting local food and healthy food to people. And I will draw your attention to, in your packet, you should see a letter of support from the Good Food Access Fund campaign supporters. And we have, I think, almost 40 organizations who are signed on officially in support of this. And you'll see the variety of interests represented there. Thank you.
Any questions from members? If not, continue on.
Hi, Mr. Chair. I'm Cheryl Hills, Executive Director of Region 5 Development Commission. Thank you all for letting me be here to talk about the Good Food Access Fund. I do want to start by saying Rachel's correct in that this does really segue well to the previous presentations that the committee has heard through the Urban Agricultural Bill. I think that it's important to note that our work through the Good Food Access is a different point of the food system. And so while the work of the Urban Agriculture Bill before this was wonderful presentations, those really do speak to the grower side, and what we're really looking at through this work is the access side and those access points and how those look differently in different parts of Minnesota. So I run an organization that does 5 lending programs. We're a regional economic development organization. We have gap funding and microfunding, and we deliver programs through the Department of Agriculture as well. And we do deliver extensive technical assistance to our borrowers. And we have worked closely with one of the food hubs that you heard about in Paul Huguenin's presentation earlier, Sprout MN, a nonprofit, whereas we do aggregation distribution, and we're opening our processing facility April 1st, and you're all welcome to that grand opening this Friday. But that that work has been over almost a decade and providing a lot of technical assistance to growers. This has been the gap in terms of the access points in our work in central Minnesota, the 10 counties that we serve around local foods. So yeah, I think you have some handouts or some information available to you through a couple of studies I just want to point you to, and you can look at later for context and reference, a little more detail. Kathy Drager at the University of Minnesota, the Regional Partnerships, did a study on grocery stores, and i.e. access points, that's what those are, small grocery stores. That data did share the economic impacts of those stores to our very small rural communities. And how important those grocery stores are, obviously, for our health impacts as well. We noticed a decline in central Minnesota when our grocery stores started to go away. Our health disparities were increased. And so we have, of our 5 counties, 3 of them are in the lowest, the bottom 10 in the 87 counties of the state of Minnesota in terms of health. And so that's an issue for us to deal with. So obviously this point of access points and grocery stores has been something we've been trying to grapple with. That's one of the reasons of my support for this. You also should have some information from the Center for Rural Policy on new ways to talk about this model of delivering food to our residents. And so I encourage you to take a look at that information as well. The reason that this is important to me, as I've stated, there is a gap in our ability to deliver technical assistance currently to these kinds of borrowers and or businesses. And they're not always just that C-store or grocery store, that mom-and-pop grocery store, which those are certainly target customers for our work. But it's also the new emerging kinds of access points like the mobile markets that you have more of, frankly, in the urban areas than we do in rural, and food pharmacies. That we have hospitals in our region that are looking at how do we take our 24-hour buildings, i.e. these hospitals, and create food pharmacies where they can also purchase food. And that is important to those people who are driving 30 miles and more to access healthy foods. And, of course, as our growers understand, and probably Mark will talk about a little bit here, is that
The CSA model, community-supported agriculture, is an access point to purchase groceries and locally grown foods and healthy foods. And so that's important for us to figure out how do we find resources to allow organizations like ours to deliver the technical assistance to those folks. The other thing I wanted to mention, too, is that you probably know this already, but just for the record, I want to state we have a robust ecosystem of organizations that deliver technical assistance across the state of Minnesota. You have the initiative foundations who have gap lendings and gap programs, and they have specialists. You have the CDFIs that are all over. You heard from HOFA, the Latino Economic Development Organization. We have tribal economic development organizations. We are never shy of types of organizations to service folks in Minnesota. The challenge that we're identifying, and hopefully this bill closes that gap for us, is being able to take resources for specifically for local food access points. That has not been an eligible sort of area for us in the other forms of dollars that we secure to deliver technical assistance. So, again, that fills a gap, but we have an ecosystem and we have a network of organizations within Minnesota to deliver that. So it's not something that we have to create from ground up and scratch. I think it's also important to mention that, again, it was really highlighted well how this supports the Food Charter objectives, and it does, and I think that was already kind of stated earlier through the urban agricultural presentation, but the access points is deliberately part of the Food Charter, which was created from folks all over the state of Minnesota. From our area of the state, in the five counties we serve, we had over 600 residents over a two-year period, planning period for a regional plan, also identify food access and healthy foods as an important economic driver and economic engine. Remember, we're an economic development organization, so my 22 elected officials, local elected officials that are my bosses, they do look at the number of jobs created, the jobs created, retained, the markets that are expanded, the multiplying impact to my small communities. And so this is for us not just a food and security issue, which certainly is important to all of us and is part of the principles of the Food Access Fund. It's also an economic driver for us, and we recognize that and appreciate it, frankly. The only couple other points I want to mention to you is the alignment with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's programs and how I also feel and will condone that this is really supportive of the kind of programs they already deliver. And well, we are a lender of some of the MDA programs, what they call, another acronym for you, the AG-BMP program. And it works extremely well from a lender perspective in working with our borrowers. And so to take this kind of resources and put it within the Department of Ag under a well-defined system that doesn't also need to be created from scratch makes a whole lot of sense to me and another reason to support it. The last point that I wanted to mention is that for us, our food hub, Sprout Food Hub, that was identified in the Department of Agriculture's report, we work with over 55 low-income growers, and it's probably creeping up there to closer to 70 now if I looked at the numbers. And those growers really are looking for different markets, market channels. So by increasing the access points, this is a no-brainer, so I apologize for being simplistic, but it certainly does help my growers in our goals in trying to approve low-income family farms incomes. So that is a goal of ours within Sprout and certainly our organization. It increases that farm-to-grocer market access, and that's important to us. So I just wanted to mention those points on it. And lastly, I will say another point that wasn't brought up earlier around the agriculture, the urban agricultural proposal to you in presentation is that I do see a really great connection between this Good Food Access Fund and that proposed legislation, because it does help us also address another issue in terms of that rural-urban divide and connections. So when we're able to utilize resources and in knowledge and individual knowledge of our farmers in rural places to those urban agriculture settings and the new emerging work that's happening across Minnesota, that's really exciting to me because that creates the we around food access and healthy communities and healthy people that and we're always looking for those opportunities to make those connections across Minnesota so it isn't an urban or a rural issue, it's a rural urban issue. So thank you for allowing me to visit.
Any questions for members? If not, proceed, sir. Hi, my name is Mark Bone. I'm from Bluebird Gardens in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. It's good to be here. It's so good to see Bud Norton. He's been our champion for a long time. I speak at conferences a lot for local growers, and what I'm seeing is such a divergence and diversity in not only how we grow, but how we get our food to people. I mean, it's like, and here you're right on that same page. This is so exciting. So we have Bluebird Gardens. It started out way back in 1978. I was a third grade teacher for like 34 years, best job in the world. But we started this in 78, and terrible time to start because everybody raised their own vegetables. They had their own garden, you know. So we started out a little bleak, but we're Scandinavian and persistent. So we hung in there, and our stands grew, our vegetable stands grew. A vegetable stand is such a good model. It's such a good way for a farmer to start, so I'm glad we're supporting this in this bill. And it's a good way to practice and get used to what people want. And so we had stands for like 30-some years. They grew and grew and grew. We even had an era where, because people are so good, we had people put their money in the box on their honor, and our business tripled when we did that because we could have more stands and be more accessible. So we're all like outside the box in what we do. But we kind of grew out of the stand model because we couldn't sell it all. And so then we evolved into the CSA model. Beautiful model to connect people to their farm. And you were talking about kids. Oh my gosh, were they excited in the harvest events to come to their farm, you know, and learn how food is grown and how food comes out of the ground. And so that was cool. But we're kind of at an era where we're growing out of the CSA model as well. The first 5 years, we did the pre-packed model with the CSA, where they got their own box, and boy, were we convenient. We delivered to 80 drop-off locations, got up to 2,200 members in our CSA, served the local area in Fargo-Moorhead. It's a beautiful, beautiful model, but nothing's easy. And so in that pre-packed box, people didn't get choice, you know, and how dare I give them kale or not give them kale every week. And so our ear was always to the rail. How do we make them happy? And so, because people want choice, convenience, and connection to the farm. That's what they want. They also want it cheap, but we're not going to say anything bad about the people in Minnesota, you know. So last year, by gosh, we thought we're going to make you happy, you know, and so we are going to give them choice. And so we did build your own box at the truck. And so if you look at the screens, oh my gosh, it was like a third grade group hug with people coming with their punch cards that reflected their order, and they put what they wanted in the box. It was beautiful. Except that we spent all this time being the store. So it got us to thinking, why are we the store? So I sent a letter to Gary Spies, who owns Service Food in Fergus Falls, and I said, why are we the store? Why don't you be our store? Why don't you be the only source of our produce in Fergus Falls? And the minute he got that in the mail, he called me and said, let's meet, you know? And so we're evolving into that, where the whole areas we've served for 40 years, we're going to be where people shop. You know that 85% of food is purchased 2 hours before it's eaten, which means the CSA is too disciplined for most people. And we served a mayor, even though we were the biggest CSA in the Midwest, we served 2 to 6% of the population. That's all. So our motto right now is CSA to everyone, and that's what we're doing. And so people in Fergus are just tap dancing on the table. You mean, oh, I can get your stuff whenever? Our tap dance bud, show them how they're doing it. You can get our produce right in the store? Yes. And so that's exactly what we're doing. But I think as we get local into all these places, we are not going to just drop it off at the loading dock. No, we're not. We're going to bring the roaring message of the farm right into the store. It's not going to be a limp little sign that says local. Talk about boring. What does local mean? It could be our country, for gosh sakes, you know? And so Bluebird Gardens and the story of the farm and videos and pictures in the field and social media. It's going to be their farm in the store. And so who's part of this network? We are so excited. Service Food in Fergus Falls, and Purim Econo Foods in Wahpeton and Bemidji, Central Market in Detroit Lakes, Larry's in Pelican, Lake and Main in Battle Lake, Hornbacher's in Fargo, Moorhead, eight stores are all so excited to, yes, have the local story of a farm right in their store. It's like pioneering. We have two awesome staff on our farm. One is from New York and one is from California, and they can't believe that this is being done. You know, and so I do workshops across the country, and we want to be a model of how this can be done. We're so excited about that. But we also, we knew our CSA members love to come to the farm. We're not going to lose that. So here's our magic woods. Oh my gosh, it's surreal. And so we're going to do farm-to-table meals in the magic woods, and weave local restaurants like, I had them in third grade, Ben Shire's North Union Brewing and Pizza, you know, to the magic woods. And involve many, many local people in that. We're also going to have a corn maze and a pumpkin harvest and all kinds of things to bring people to the farm. We want to restore an old barn and have it be a seminar for learning and even be a juice barn where people come and drink juice right from the farm. But to teach people about farms and agriculture and all of those amazing things. So our farm has evolved. And all of us evolve. We all change and evolve. Our challenge right now is, as we switch models, is like financing, and we need investors. So if there would be any way, this isn't what this bill is about, but to have investors who want to make a difference, you know, because we could sure use them right now. That would be cool. But anyway, just briefly, we have two big missions on our farm. One is, and they're shown on signs, one is Bluebird Gardens, welcome to your farm, because it's their farm. But the other sign, it says Bluebird Gardens, biologically farming for you. And the lady who was talking about the compost is exactly right. The most incredible part of our creation is right below our feet in the soil. 2013, remember that spring? Well, there wasn't a spring. You know, we had winter, and then we had avalanches of rain. Good comes out of bad. You know what we realized then? We got to do something besides farm to combat the forces of nature. And so we bought new land so that we could do alternating strips of crop and cover crop all over our farm. We started with 10 acres. Now we have 404. We do, I could talk about cover crops forever. In fact, I do on the road, but even on the vegetable
strips. We have 5 minutes left.
You bet. People say I talk too much. That can't be true. But yes, I know. Yeah. Anyway, yep. So anyway, what it's all about is cover crops hold organic matter, which makes everything happen. We don't need buffer strips. We need cover crops. I watch the soil right now. Change below my feet. And why does this matter? Well, it's biological farming. We have to make our nation healthy. And so it's organic matter in the soil, which changes the physiology. It's like so exciting to see your soil change. And then it's the fungi and the bacteria doing a symbiotic dance with the plant root and also adding the chemistry. And so plants can make any of these things. And we're eating a lot of simple sugars. If you don't have biological farming, we're eating simple sugars. But if you let all this happen with micronutrients and that, it's like nutrition happens. What's happened in the last 20 years is kind of scary. These are obesity chart maps. And 70% of what we eat is processed. 90% of what we eat has a herbicide that's known to chelate with the micronutrients, which means all it's going to make is simple sugars. And so we're up to 38% obese right now. And it's like, oh my gosh, the farm has to become our pharmacy. And it's not any pill that you read about. And so that's why our goal to go in the store is so big. It's that. And so why this good food access bill? Well, it's because it's doing just that. It's getting food to people. That's what it's all about. For example, there's a 14% decline in rural grocery stores. But Okay, yep, I'm about done. And it hurts small communities, and so the bill is all about exactly what I'm talking about. And so it's a statewide tool. And so if you have any questions ever...
Mr. Chair, I just want to make it obviously Mark's presentation is great. It does point out in 1 second that it does, that's a food access point a farmer is through the CSA model. And I just want to mention it does dovetail quite well with some of the work we're doing with physicians and certainly the whole audience within Minnesota that's dealing with mental health issues and connecting mental health patients to food access and healthy foods. And so that's one model, that CSA and the grocery store model, and I think the Good Food Access Fund encompassed all of that. So thank you for that.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, reviewing the amendments here, I would like to offer the A3 amendment at this time. This is basically cleanup language. There's no substantive changes, and so I would move the A3 amendment.
Members, any questions on the A3 amendment? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
And opposed, same sign. Amendment is approved.
Chair. And Mr. Chairman, the A2 amendment, I'm not going to move it this time. I am working with the grocers, and I'm committed to work with the grocers and others, so we will not be moving that amendment at this time, Mr. Chairman. And in closing, I would simply entertain any questions and ask for your support.
We did have one question from Representative Nornis, who may be doing the tap dance.
Yes. I got a change of shoes, however. I didn't have a question. I was just going to point out, I hope you noticed the enthusiasm. I did.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mark, for being here. It was a loss to public education when he retired from teaching, but great to the agriculture people. So keep it up. We enjoy his food.
My only question on this bill, it sounds very good, but are we talking more of a seasonal aspect? Fresh fruits, vegetables in Minnesota are seasonal. Can this be a year-round thing or mostly in the summertime?
Hi, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Really, our goal with this bill is to be flexible. So while it definitely will support a lot of the local agricultural farmers who are providing fresh produce and healthy foods, we envision that it also would support a grocery store buying more conventional products through the pipeline. But I think the key to note is that without the local retailers, farmers like Mark Bowen will not, you know, the markets that they're trying to sell to will dry up. That we're, you know, the definitely the trend is a reduction in small grocery stores around the state. And so this is, the goal of this program is to help to reduce that trend or reverse the trend.
Representative Bly.
I'll be quick, guy. I just wanted to say how much I am pleased with this bill and really support it. Representative Hamilton, thank you for bringing it forward. I happen to suffer from heart disease, and I know that the importance of healthy food and its availability. And my first teaching job, I taught out in Milan, Minnesota, and at that time it was very difficult to find good produce. Now that's changed, and it's different. I understand the grocery store in Milan is very healthy and doing well. But I think that having that access in the rural Minnesota is really important for everybody to be able to get the good food that you produce. I also think that we are beginning to explore greenhouses and what you can do throughout the year so that growing doesn't just have to be during the growing season.
Chair Hamilton, final thoughts and comments?
I ask for your support.
And the bill would move to government operations as amended.
Oh, I'm sorry. So I'd renew my motion, and it goes to GovOps, and I don't think I clarified that initially. So I'd renew my motion that this be referred to GovOps.
So House File 3363 moved as amended to government operations. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion has been approved. And your bill is on the way, Chair Hamilton. And with that, we have session coming up. The meeting is adjourned.